Hello and welcome to episode 213 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Valentine, and Chris Weston. So, like a train slowly plodding into the station that is 2021, here we arrive at the terminus of the year, the last show before we pack up shop for the Christmas break. And it's you and me, and a bit of a look back on the year that's been. But before we get to that, Chris, let's just think about the last 7 days. Has it been exciting? Has it been exhilarating? Have you been holding onto your chair through the sheer thrill of it?
I think that would be pushing it a little bit, if I'm honest, in terms of excitement. It's been a good few days, all in all. Caught up with a few people I've not seen for a while, which is unusual right at the moment, so we don't get to go out very much. And the Omicron news and ongoing events make it even more or less likely, I guess, as we're heading into Christmas. So it was nice just to see a few people. In terms of work, it's all sort of closing down quite nicely, and you know, customers are doing their thing, and that's great. So yeah, I reckon I'm doing okay there. Quite happy with that. Tried to watch some cricket, you know, that exciting, you know, start of the Ashes series, which all went a bit like horribly wrong, and I spent sort of 24 hours with my chin on my chest about that. But you know, there's time to go yet, and I for one am not downhearted. It, you know, there's plenty of chances for that to come back. So yeah, it's been fine, Matt. I can't really complain. How about yourself?
Well, we've completed the annual family ritual of all the birthdays and the wedding anniversaries and what have you. Since we last spoke, we went out for what only be described as an enormous meal, Italian restaurant in the centre of Richmond, which was very exciting. And that was to celebrate the anniversary. And then he had his youngest birthday at the beginning of this week, so he got very excited. And he's now, I think even at this point, heavily ensconced in Airfix kits, which he takes great delight from. My wife and I spend great moments of fear, I think, that he's going to drop glue all over expensive furniture, quite frankly. But, you know, there we go. And then this, having had lots of conversations over the last few weeks about cyber on the show, we have a real-life disaster unfolding, potentially, with the 4J vulnerability.
Log4j. That's what I was going to call it. I was thinking to myself, oh, I can't remember what this is called. Is it called Log4J? And it is called Log4J. And
it is called Log4J. I've been working with it for the last 2 days.
It's another one of those things that reminds me that it's quite good not to be in a position where you're running IT, because essentially you're in a position quite often where you've got 100 things could go wrong at any time, and you've got the money and resources to mitigate about 6 of them. And it's quite a perilous situation to be, frankly, and I don't envy anybody who's having to delve into their systems and pull lots of wires and string out in order to retie them up in a different way to mitigate this particular problem, especially if they've lost data or there's some breach, because it's just horrendous.
Yes. I mean, the short version of it, as I understand it, is there's a set of open source libraries that are used by Java applications to be able to log stuff, and there is this cracking, enormous, great gap in the way that was written that means that you can do horrible things from afar pretty easily, by the sounds of it. And it's one of those pieces of code that seems to have ended up embedded in all sorts of things, not least Minecraft, which Microsoft had to do a patch for back on Friday because it had been compromised by it. And it's one of those things where it's quite difficult to tell whether you have got it or not, because you might have used it yourself in an organisation, but you also may well have it embedded in software. So there's been a lot of frantic calling to vendors over the last few days to say, so, has it? And then if they has, then so, when's the patch coming? Which is, it does throw up one thing. I'm not anti-open source in any way, but it does throw up one of the risks of open source software, which is that you don't entirely know what it is that you've got, because it will often be, you know, even commercially licensed software will be cobbled together through certain open source things. I know, and in the weirdest of places, I know our ovens, when we got them installed a few years ago, they're German, and they came with a whole list of the open source software that they were using. God help us if my oven becomes vulnerable to some sort of horrible virus attack. Thankfully, it's not attached to the internet. It's just attached to the electricity network, but you never know these.
Yeah, they'll deliver a hot fix if that's the... The fact is... that you're right. I mean, open source software is a little bit the Wild West. You don't know where it's come from. You don't know what people have used. But anything that's used regularly and is important in that sense, like this particular library or others that are used a lot, they have lots of people looking at them and modifying them and forking them all the time, right? So it's not quite the enormous, you know, gaping hole that I think maybe it could be. And I think commercial software still has the same problem. I mean, if I have a team writing software and we've got an application that's running and it's sitting there running quite happily, it could have a horrible security hole. It's just never been noticed or exploited. And the one thing, it's one something I learned in, I guess, in the year 2000 problem, that, and I was a bit like, oh, well, you know, this is such a big and unwieldy problem. There are so many, you know, so many things could be wrong, embedded software, you know, that nobody's looking at and all this kind of thing. But what turned out is actually that all important software has an owner or somebody who's responsible for it, actually, it turns out, or pretty much all that software. And therefore, yeah, you're right, you would be phoning vendors, then all the vendors will be thinking, oh my God, and they'll be going down the chain of who's dealing with this, who owns this, and eventually you'll get to the person who it's their job to know about it. And now if they don't know about it because it was handed over from somebody else who really did know about it and they left and they have to get on with it, or they get down to the person who goes, oh yeah, I know exactly where that's used, then let's have a look, and oh no, it's okay, or, you know, I think I'm optimistic that most software that's used and is important has got owners of one sort or another, but I could be wrong at times, but I think I feel that.
I think you might have been out of operational IT for a while. It's the its and chits, as I like to call them. It's the stuff that just lingers around and nobody quite ever gets rid of, and it's, you know, I don't know. We're just arranging it at my place. We're doing a scan, and that's actually probably the most foolproof way of doing it, is actually to get a company in to be able to scan specifically for the vulnerability across the network and find out if they can spot it in things that we didn't know it was in. We've contacted all of our major software vendors. We've been assured by all of them, bar two, that there isn't an issue. There's a couple of them where there is, and there's patches on the way. But it's an interesting then set of questions you're confronted with. So do we turn off services until we know that they're clear if they have the vulnerability, or do we take the risk that actually, because it's behind firewalls and because it has a level of protection that we've configured to be extra secure, that it's probably okay and that the risk of it being infiltrated is less than the risk of turning it off for a while? Can you even turn it off and it comes back up again? I mean, that's the other, with the very complex world of software where organizations now find themselves in, unless things were specifically designed to be turned off, turning them back on again in a corporate enterprise environment can have quite unpredictable results sometimes.
Well, yes, you know, you have a complex collection of things all relying on each other at different times, and just turning one off might not seem to cause you any problems, but you don't find out about it until you try and turn it back on. As you say, it's all good fun, you know. That's the software world we live in, and it's still pretty amateurish in many ways, right? We're still, IT is still a bit of a cottage industry in many areas that. And we try to pretend that it isn't, and it all looks very smart and swish, and, you know, it turns on when you press the button. But gosh, there's still a lot of things done on a wing and a prayer, and with sticky tape and glue.
That's for sure. Well, I'm sure that it's still going to be an issue when we get back in the new year. Hopefully, it won't have caused too much damage. Never knows. Oh, the delights of cybersecurity. There we go. Anyway, as I mentioned at the top, this week we are going to be talking about 2021, the year that we have just about, bar the last, 16 days or so, have knocked on the head. And we're going to be doing it through the medium of questions that have been asked from the audience. So let's crack on.
It's become a bit of a tradition recently for us to ask our Signal group for questions, Matt, because, well, they come up with good questions, and when we need inspiration, it's a good place to go. So we asked them about the year and some questions that we could talk about that reflect, you know, what's gone by in the last 12 months. So we had one from Cy Cornwell, who asked about, he says, office work has changed significantly. Many people work from home or just do 1 to 2 days a week in the office, which is very true. He says, if the pandemic reaches a less serious phase, do you see people reverting or being forced to revert to old working styles, or is the genie out of the bottle? So what do you think, Matt?
So I was on another podcast last week. Sorry. Don't throw me out. And it was a podcast called The Nowhere Office, which is something Julia Hobsbawm is doing. And one of the things I reflected on during that interview was how we're talking about this stuff as if it's all brand new. The idea of working in multiple places, of having geographically distributed teams, of working from home, And the two things that I sort of pointed out, the first was that when I started working in 1993, even though I didn't have an externally addressable email address, because such things were still fairly rare, the organisation for whom I worked, which is KPMG, a large proportion of the consultants there were working remotely from the office. They were in dial-up connections and CC mail, and it was all horrible, but they were working in this way and had been working for many years in the early 90s. It was 30 years ago that one of the other people on the podcast talked about how it would be almost unfathomable that somebody would be interviewed and then given a job on the basis of just video interviews alone. I pointed out that I was interviewed for my job by my boss at Reuters in 2006 via video call. Admittedly, I was in the London office, but he was in the New York office, and I didn't actually meet him for about 6 weeks after I started the job. Global organisations are working like this for years. The thing that's changed, and it changed about 15 years ago, was broadband at home. It used to be that if you wanted to work in a distributed team in a global team, to be able to be in any way effective at it, you had to be able to get into the office, because that's the only place you could have a reasonable quality network connection. That's all changed. I think what the experience of the pandemic has done is it's pushed that style of working into organisations that weren't doing it before. But that's not the same as it wasn't there before. It really was. And most of the organisations that I've worked in my career have been remote, you know, multi-location, geographically dispersed organisations who don't all sit in the same office day in, day out. And I think that the revelation for organisations who have now understood that they can work in other ways is twofold. First of all, I don't think people who now have that flexibility want to lose that flexibility. It might not be that everybody's working remotely from the office all the time. I think that some organisations have taken a stand on this where they have forced the issue already. I think I mentioned when I went to a conference up in Manchester for housing people last month that some of the larger housing associations, who themselves are already geographically dispersed, have made the decision to be able to get rid of head offices already. They can see it. They're building around hub models rather than head office models, and that they've done now. They've made it, and they've given up the leases. The other challenge, though, that I see is that there is management that understands that in person is just different from being online, is just different from being in multiple offices, is just different from being in one big office. And there is management that thinks that one is superior to the other and have a preference and state their preference and force it. And the problem that that attitude is going to have, I noticed that Dyson are now publicly saying about how they don't have anybody remote working. I met somebody from Dyson earlier in the summer, and they said they were already having massive issues around retention and of recruitment because people don't want to work in the middle of Somerset or wherever it is, Wiltshire, isn't it, where they're based. And they certainly don't want to work there if they're going to be 5 days a week. Some people will. But what I think the next phase of this starts to look like is that canny organisations will start to realise that when they come to recruit, and it is a candidate's market at the moment in many, many areas for a number of reasons. When you come to recruit, if you open up to say we will recruit from anywhere in the country, you have a much bigger pool of people available to you. And it doesn't take many people to start doing that before actually, for certain types of skills and certain types of roles, unless you're living in or working in an incredibly attractive place, you're going to have to start recruiting across the country as a whole, or a much broader geographic spread than just commutable to our office. And that, I think, might be the thing that means this is here to stay, because it will be the search for hard-to-find expertise and people that you won't be able to do by just basing it on the idea that you have to be within a catchment area close to your office.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. And all of what you say is true about the fact that if it changes elsewhere, it's going to change for you whether you like it or not. It's not something you can insulate yourself from. And maybe the idea that we have to turn up in the same place every day, and it's almost some places, I don't know whether you feel this, but some workplaces over the years have just felt a bit like school. Everybody comes in the morning, and it's almost like you have to take a register because, you know, is everybody there? Because if you're not, something must be up. And over time, in the last few years, people would say, oh, can I work from home on Friday or Monday or Wednesday or whatever it is, because maybe I've got a report to finish and I don't want to be disturbed or whatever it might be. And the answer might have been yes, but it might have been no. But I think now, if somebody says no, if a manager says, I'm not sure about that, the answer, you know, the response, why not, is a much harder one to answer, because you can't just say, well, you know, if I do it for you, I've got to do it for everybody, right? well, or you know, we like, you know, it's not how we work here. All that kind of, as you say, it's kind of, that's been shattered now. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely out of the bottle. How it evolves in individual organisations will be another matter.
And I think that's something else, isn't it? But I think we may well see that for, you know, some people prefer being in office, some people prefer a mix, some people prefer not being in office at all. I can very credibly see that those could be selling points for the right type of candidate. And, you know, I for years have been saying that actually promising of a fixed desk in the same office for 5 days a week when organisations have been heading into, you know, hot desking models and 60% provision of desks and all that stuff, that the fixed desk that is yours for the time that you work with would be seen as a perk for some people. And I think that that kind of thing, you know, some organisations will say, we want you to be here. But I do think if you're going to take the kind of Dyson model of it and say, we want everybody in the office 5 days a week, you're really limiting. In the same way that saying you've got to move to Wiltshire really limits your candidate pool. When actually now we've learned that you can have this opportunity to be able to recruit from anywhere in the country. So I don't know. We'll see. But I think this is going to be the sort of thing. I think it would be, particularly because it's a candidate's market at the moment, that's going to be the thing that will shape the next wave of this. And that'll be different for different sectors, and it will be different for different types of profession as well. But I think that that is probably going to be where the next wave of this comes. So next up is a couple of questions, actually. One from, again, from Cy Cornwell, and then also one from Friend of the Pod. So Lisa's question is, will the Great Resignation be followed by the Great Retraining or something else? And then Cy sort of related to that, there's been a lot of talk about the Great Resignation. Was that a US-centric reaction to the pandemic, or will we see it more in the UK too? What do you reckon?
Well, I would say that the question, is it happening in most places? I think the data that we've seen, we've definitely seen work at IDC, and I've also seen data in other, you know, in the FT and places like that, that show that, yeah, in most places it has happened. It's happened to different extents, but we've definitely seen it in the UK. Lots of reasons why.
What do we mean by the Great Resignation? Because this isn't just about fluidity in the job market, is it? This is basically saying people just going, I've had enough, stick your job.
I think that's part of it. I think, what do we mean by the Great Resignation? I think it is quite basic. It is lots of people changing roles, right? And it is about the fluidity. I think there is a subset of that, which is, yeah, some people just saying, I've had enough of this, because sometimes it's, you know, you've been, you know, I haven't been happy here for quite a long time, and now it's almost a chicken and egg situation. There is fluidity, there are jobs available because people are hiring, or people have moved on and their positions are available, so now I'm going to do it, right? So there's a bit of a like a snowball effect where as positions are created, more people see those positions and they think, do you know what, I'm gonna move on. So I think the motivations are quite varied, and I think it's certainly, I did see some data about whether it's, you know, more in tech or more in things like, you know, retail or manufacturing, because we tend to think about tech a lot in our jobs, but actually this has happened across all types of sector, right? It's not just a tech thing. It's people who are working in shops have decided they're going to work in another shop, or they're going to go and do something else, right? It's things like that. So yeah, we are seeing it everywhere. And the question is, how long will it last? Is this something that's been created by the pandemic and is a knee-jerk reaction to what's going on? Or as we've just been talking about, has the change in the number of opportunities available to an individual, maybe with the geographic location of where they work, is it going to be more of a long-term sort of bubbling under of change?
I think the question that Lisa put, though, about also, is it about people retraining, is interesting, because I do think this, as I said, the idea of it just about being about fluidity in the job market, and for the UK specifically about there being shortages of certain types of people with certain types of skills, means that it's in some areas now it appears to be easier for people to make the decision to be able to move jobs. But move jobs in the kind of hype around the Great Resignation, it does feel more like, no, I've had enough of this office job, I'm going to go and become a farmer kind of thing, or going to do something that is more intrinsically motivating rather than intrinsically motivating or whatever. It's a really interesting question about the extent to which people are retraining themselves. A friend of the show, Lee Cox, who we had on a few weeks back, has now taken his first step into the world of being involved with digital delivery, having refocused what he wanted to do from in the shipping and logistics industry and then going and becoming a London Black Cab driver. I think Lee's story is one about how hard the retraining and shift is. You know, he put a lot of effort in and he's actually, for a number of reasons, very well connected. And that I think that that thing around mid-career career change is as hard as it has ever been.
I really think so. I mean, I know there's a lot of romantic, you know, wistful thinking about the idea that people are changing their whole careers all of a sudden and it's happening a lot. I'm not entirely convinced that's the case. And I don't think organisations, right, that we are in a really tough economic situation. Yeah, organisations are recruiting, they're trying to grow. There's a lot of investment money out there ready to go into organisations that they think are going to grow and give us some money back. But times are still tough and there is not a massive amount of training budget out there to say, oh, don't worry, we're going to take on a whole bunch of people who used to be this and we're going to train them into doing that. It's yes, it's there, but of course people still want their, you know, kind of experienced people who are not too experienced, but, you know, experienced enough and aren't going to, you know, make a mess and cause them any trouble. So I do think that there's a lot of retraining, reskilling requirement. How much of that's really there? And we're not just talking about because of the pandemic. There's the whole question around automation that we expect to see coming in the next few years, and how people's jobs will change because of that. And yeah, I mean, there is a retraining element, but it's still the last resort in many organisations because there's not money there.
And I think that you know, is retraining the role and responsibility of the employer, or is it something that is down to the individual? And I think increasingly we're seeing that employers think it's down to the individual. And I think learning and development has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. I've made two sideways steps into new areas in my career, and both of them have come about because of opportunities that I've discovered through people in my network. They haven't come about because I just on the cuff applied for something that was new. So I think there's some interesting challenges ahead for where there are definitely skills gap at the moment, but it doesn't feel like anybody's really stepping up to say it is our responsibility to fill them. I think that would be the really interesting part.
And we've been waiting all night for a question from Chris King. It's always going to be a challenging and thought-provoking question from Mr. King.
Oh, a question from Chris King that we can actually read out on.
Indeed. And I'm going to try to read this one out on air, as it were. And what Chris says is, if hybrid cars still require the use of fossil fuels and hybrid meetings still expect someone to be in a meeting room, is the very nature of hybrid an unnecessary clinging on to a past a number of us want to break free from? Try not to think of Chris King in that video by Queen. Should we be killing hybrid before it becomes business as usual, Matt?
See, I don't know why, but I've leaked from that for the video of Miley Cyrus, but featuring Chris King on a wrecking ball, which, yeah, I could do without that. Anyway, I think this is a fascinating question, this, and I think is a bit of a reflection about the way that change tends to happen, which is it's very rare that you get the quantum leap. It's very rare that you get the big step change. It does happen occasionally, but it is actually, I think, exceptional. And even something like the World Wide Web wasn't a massive great leap. It was a whole bunch of factors and a bunch of familiarities that happened in other places that meant that the World Wide Web could happen. But I think there is something very interesting about this idea that is hybrid working, are hybrid cars a rethinking of the future based exclusively on the current and the past, and that actually they're a stepping stone to be able to actually to make the change properly. I think hybrid cars are basically the last gasp of the ICE model of transmission of power for cars. I think it is the likes of particularly Toyota clinging on to what they know, desperately trying to not find themselves left in the past, but not being able to make the leap forward. It's like Polaroid making a digital camera that still somehow involved lots of chemicals, bits of wet paper. It doesn't quite work. And it's I think actually there's something really interesting about this idea of framing things as hybrid being the future, as opposed to saying hybrid is just a stepping stone so that we can get to where there are better ways of working.
Yeah, I think I'd probably be a bit more positive, or you know, on the basis that I think the hybrid car was a way to get cars that have the new technology, but don't suffer from limitations. And that, of course, the issues around battery life and range and all that kind of thing, they're the issues that we're having to deal with electric cars. And whilst those are being fixed now and a lot more wholly electric cars are being sold, that kind of hybrid seemed to be a kind of stepping stone. But it was there for a good reason, I think. It was saying, okay, you want an electric car, but you don't want it to have fuel. That's what you're worried about. So let's fix that. Now, whether it's a good idea, whether that's a sensible thing to do is another matter. And I think hybrid, in terms of working, is very similar, right? It's like, well, okay, we can see that there's this new way of working, and as much as we can talk to each other and we've got, you know, extremely good video, audio capability, we can do it over a touch of a button. It's not like, you know, a Polycom set from 10 years ago or something. And so that's how we're going to work now. But actually, our culture and, you know, the way we've worked, and also this kind of human thing that we've grown up with in terms of our connections and our meetings, mean that we maybe can't make that shift entirely. But the hybrid idea, I think, seems to me to be a kind of acceptance that the digital... You're going to have these two communities of people. You're going to have the people that are in office, and you're going to have the people that are out and about. And there's enough of them now to make it a truly kind of a permanent state or a semi-permanent state. Now, is that really a stepping stone into a new way of working? Maybe even probably. But the timescales to me seem quite far out. You know, I don't think I'll be in work when nobody goes into a meeting room together, right?
I think, yeah. So, well, back to my earlier point, though, that actually people have not been going into a meeting room together for decades in certain circumstances, so that's nothing new. I go back to my safe place with this kind of idea of kind of technical evolutions is music industry. And as you were talking and thinking about how in about 2001, I loved Minidisc. Minidisc was awesome because it was like CD but more portable. It was recordable, and it was great. And these tiny little players that had tiny little discs that contained a whole album's worth of material. Now, in hindsight, Minidisc looks like the stupidest idea ever, because actually we know now that what that would evolve into was MP3 players with initially mechanical hard discs and then into solid state and then into streaming. And then you don't need storage. And then actually the thing that I coveted with the idea of the mini disc, utterly, utterly pointless, because you just don't need any of it anymore, because you just stream from the internet. And I wonder whether that's the thing, isn't it? We have this, at the time, there is a tendency for us to say, this next thing will be the future, as if it's some sort of permanent state to be able to help people, to be able to think that somehow that will be, once you make that transition, it will be cool and it will be fine because it will be fixed. And that's the myth, isn't it? And so maybe this is the thing about being able to say hybrid work isn't the future. Hybrid work is just the evolution of what happens next. And actually, we do need to come back to office work for, you know, to a very great extent, has been left pretty much untouched by any great change over about 150 years. You know, the nature of the office space is pretty much untouched, unless, you know, the furniture changes, a bit less woody, a bit more kind of white and stuff, and it got, you know, bigger and there was more space, and then over the last 20 years it got smaller and tighter. And I was reading something like the average office worker now has 7 square meters less space than they did 20 years ago. And that's all because office space has been designed around the needs of the chief financial officer, primarily, that we have redesigned the whole thing to be able to maximise cost efficiency of office space. And then you give opportunity for people to be able to work at home for a year and a half, and they go, yeah, you know, I don't want to come back in sometimes or nearly as much because it's not actually that good.
Yeah, and I take that, but also I think that, you know, commerce business hasn't changed very much in the last 100 years either. And so... At the end of the day, so let's take retail, right? Retail has gone through lots of changes in the past. You know, you can go back to once upon a time, even when I was, you know, when I was very young and being wheeled around supermarkets by my mum in a pushchair, there was stuff on the shelves, but there's nowhere near as much stuff as we've got now. You know, there's a massive abundance of stuff. So we had these enormous supermarkets. We got away from the kind of Arkwright's, you know, counter. Go and get you this and go and get you that. Self-service came along, and we've evolved and evolved that retail model, but essentially it's the same thing. I've got some stuff here, and I'm going to collect it here for your convenience because it means that you can come to one place for a bunch of stuff, Or you now got a bunch of stuff here, and maybe it's all cameras or it's all motorcycles or whatever. So you've got a choice, you know, of this one thing you want to buy. And the reason it's all here is because A, you want to take it home with you, and B, it's a convenience for you to do that. So retail has been like that forever, and now we've suddenly got this rapid change to online mail order, what I would call mail order, but you know what I mean, online mail order, internet shopping. And that is a real, that's kind of, you know, I'm going to, you know what, Matt, I'm going to say a paradigm shift, right? But the, you know, that's genuine change. But we always expect that things are going to continue to move on, and oh, this is just the next step, and there'll be the next step, and there'll be a next step, and the next step. And sometimes that happens, and sometimes it doesn't happen, and sometimes it takes a lot longer than we think. So, you know, the aeroplane was only, you know, it was only 100 years ago, really, that the aeroplanes were commonly in the skies. And then the next thing was going to be flying cars and jetpacks and, you know, all of that kind of thing. But actually, if you think about it, you know, we had Concorde in the 70s, but we've arguably gone back from that, that kind of supersonic flight that we had. And then there was going to be planes that go into space and then come down again. It's going to be, you know, 45 minutes to the US and all that kind of thing. Well, that hasn't happened, actually. The ever-moving outcome hasn't happened. We kind of settled into a thing, actually, this is all we can do, or this is good enough, and therefore we're not going to move on. You know, we're still building railways, right? So, and for good reasons in many ways, right? But still, it's a Victorian idea. So I think there are certainly times where you go, okay, well, this is clearly just a stepping stone because there are going to be other things. And there are times where actually it's not. Actually, it's going to be steady state for a long time. But we don't always know when that's going to be, because the ideas are always there. We're always going to have this new thing, but it doesn't actually happen.
So penultimate question, another one from Chris King. Chris, you're on fire. In 2021, a great number of businesses angling to sell them to the next, sorry, as the great pandemic saviours, used the phrase tech for good to show their tools and platforms could end the pandemic. What exactly is tech for good, and how big a bunch of charlatans are those orcs?
That's an extremely cynical way to put it. And I don't suppose we'd expect much else from our correspondent, but the question about how many of them are charlatans, I would say, is exactly the same amount of charlatans that are in any type of business, and as much as, yes, a bunch of them are. But I think also this whole tech for good thing is, some of it is wishful thinking, in as much as we always think that something's going to change the world and actually we're going to solve all the problems, like with IoT, right? And IoT is still a big part of this, you know, save the world thing. Oh, we're going to know how much of that's being used, so we're not going to use so much of it. It's like refrigeration, for example, in supermarkets. Actually, all your refrigerators are all running at different temperatures, and some of them are running too cold, some of them aren't running cold enough, and you're not, you know, actually, if we know exactly how cold they're all running, you can reduce your energy bill by 10%, and that will save the world. And there's something in that, but all you're really doing is you're adding more data, another job, another set of things that people have to monitor. And they just don't, it doesn't, in my experience, that kind of thing really is sustained, because it's producing a saving that actually people can't be buggered with the messing about of. And then you've got to maintain those IoT devices. And, you know, if the IoT device that's monitoring that fridge isn't working, what does the fridge turn off, or does the fridge keep running, but we just don't worry about it? And if one stops working, well, do we go and mend it, or do we wait for five to stop working? And when five stop working, you know, all of these things, they just add to the complexity. So I think there's a bunch of things that I would say are tech for good, which add to complexity, and therefore they become almost part of the problem. But by the same token, there's lots of great stuff that you can do. There's lots of energy efficiency, health and safety, protecting people, all of these sort of things that we can do to monitor people, to monitor their well-being, that I would say that fall into the tech for good model. But they all need careful consideration. I don't know. I mean, Matt, you're in your line of work. I guess there are some of these things which sort of impinge on your world. What do you think?
I think there's two. There's two separate things here. There's using technology to be able to, I don't know, move forward the human lot. But I think there's also an understanding of the way in which marketing in tech firms works. And that's the bit that I think is maybe what Chris is alluding to where he talks about Charlatan. There's a very set format for a technology presentation, like a big showpiece thing. I saw it at Microsoft with the annual sales conference that they did every year in America. Went to a couple of times. I saw it at a sales conference that Google ran. I've seen it in customer or partner facing events run by other tech companies. And what you do is you start off with a big, here we are, this is why we're great, look at how big we are kind of presentation. And then as a kind of, okay, let's switch to the humility now, you then do a presentation that shows about how your technology has been helping to save lives. And that might be through, or improve lives, and it might be through, you know, being able to use big data to be able to prove how we can get fresh water to, or whatever. And then you'll have these beautiful pieces, and they'll have that plinky plonky guitar and piano music that is so beloved of people doing this kind of emotional heartstrings kind of video. And it's, yeah, they're kind of doing stuff, but to be honest, particularly software companies, they're giving away stuff that's free. And they probably can set it off as a tax deduction for charitable contribution, even though it was free, because there's no incremental cost of distributing software, even software as a service, you know, scratch the surfaces of what's going on. And it's there because they like the good news stories that they get from associating themselves with good causes, which, if I'm blunt, I've been reading Dan Lyon's book, Lab Rats, which is a fascinating expose of the current state of organisations and work, particularly in America. And, you know, if you really want to do tech for good, pay taxes. That's what you should do. Just pay your tax. Stop trying to avoid it. Stop trying to be able to come up with complex loopholes to be able to stop paying it. Pay your tax. Sell your product. Make your profit. Pay your tax. That would be tech for good.
Yeah, it's unfortunately there's quite a libertarian streak through a lot of tech companies, aren't they, who believe that they can spend the money better than the government can.
Absolutely.
And sometimes, you know, no doubt everybody can find something in government that's wasteful or whatever, but it doesn't end up with joined approach then. It ends up with somebody doing something, you know, riding in on a white horse and saying, okay, look what I've done, but a one-off effort really doesn't help anybody. It needs to be consistent and coordinated and aligned, doesn't it? So yeah, I think there's a lot to be there, Matt.
Yeah, and I think the issue is that if you not only are not paying your taxes, but also making a bigger and bigger gulf between not only how wealthy you are as an organisation with the rest of the planet, but also how wealthy the people at the top of that organisation are, even in comparison to the people at the bottom of that organisation, let alone to the rest of the planet. Any other story about tech for good? Yeah.
So the final question tonight then, Matt, we're going to address is from Tony Harper, who asked, well, he first asked, what sci-fi future have we progressed most towards in 2021? And as a follow-up, he said that as 2022 is the year George Jetson was born, you know, where are the flying cars?
I think the sci-fi future that we have progressed most towards is obviously some sort of global pandemic one where there is a chance that we all die. I think we've done really well in 2021 to progress down that route. And I think the little dramatic twist at the end with this latest variant is pure Hollywood.
Is it like Day of the Triffid, do you think? Is it, you know, we could all end up, you know, stumbling around it?
Yeah, I mean, I also saw a thing today where it was talking about how Boris Johnson was now in a political dilemma where does he save the planet by making decisions that are the right, you know, right thing for the country, or does he make decisions as the right thing to be able to save the Conservative Party? And what I realised was that we've now got, you know, there's that famous kind of discussion about self-driving cars and the ethical models that need to underpin them to be able to make a decision about whether to mow down the granny or the woman with the child in the pushchair or whatever the scenario is. And we now have that kind of AI ethical decision, but it's being made by a complete incompetent, and unfortunately we are all the roadkill, which worries me really deeply. I think, yeah, that kind of sci-fi future, I think we're well on track for. The thing about where are flying cars, well, I'd take it one step back. Before you can have flying cars, I would posit that you need to be able to have self-driving cars, because the idea of manually driven flying cars is too horrific to be able to imagine. And the question I'd ask is, so we've gone a bit quiet on that self-driving, completely autonomous cars by 2020 or 2019, or is it now 2024, or is it 3636, or when exactly? And I think the problems are basically the same. There's some amazing strides that have been able to be made to be able to get almost autonomous cars, but the gap between almost autonomous cars and autonomous cars gets exponentially harder. And I think that's where the flying cars are yet. They're waiting for the ground-based self-driving versions to be developed before they all stick hover blades on them or something.
Well, I think that's a fair point. And my feelings on self-driving cars, as well as things like general AI, are, well, you know, I've said them over and over again. And I agree, you know, we're not going to have self-driving cars in any meaningful sense. But we, in terms of what sci-fi future we progress towards, you know, I was listening to something the other day about autonomous drone, or autonomous warfare, right? This idea that, you know, we can have, and we already...
Oh, is this the reflection?
Yeah, yeah. And the idea that you can have, and there are, you know, small, you can have tiny drones, very tiny things that can just essentially look for somebody, you know, look for a male aged between, you know, 16 and 40 and fly next to them and just blow up, right? And you can have swarms of these things just released into the population. And this isn't really, this isn't science fiction now, it's a deliverable thing. And this idea that the problem is, if you make one of those, or if you make 100 of them, or 1,000 of them, or a million of them, the chance that they just go off and do it by mistake is definitely there. It's not like nuclear weapons where you could say, oh well, somebody's got to press the button, then yes, it might be a mistake where that flock of geese we think is a US missiles and the Soviets, all of that. But that's a big, somebody's got to make a big decision to press the button. They haven't just got to leave the door open. And that's quite a scary prospect. Just to hear the buzzing of a tiny drone behind you.
It is. And one of the most interesting books I've read this year, I've read lots of interesting, but one of them is a thing called Humankind. And it's an exploration of actually how inherently humans are actually probably quite nice people. But there's been a concerted effort through religion and news and a bunch of other things to be able to have more of a jaded vision about humanity who just left to fester. This is the idea of the wood stuff you put on things, very thin, the veneer theory, which is that humanity in stable state is just a veneer, and if you crack through it, then the whole thing will fall apart. And the book Humankind basically talks about how there's a lot of evidence to show that's complete bunkum, and actually, left to our own devices, we probably just all get on and it's all fairly cool. One of the things in that book is about how in warfare, the estimates are something like only about 20% of soldiers in armed conflict will ever shoot. Most people won't. Actually, when it comes down to it, in the field of battle, which is completely counter to what we see in dramatic representations of it, where everybody's going hell for leather, but in actual field of battle, most people won't shoot. The killing is done by a tiny minority. And that's what I think is most scary about some of these emerging ideas around autonomous, intelligent or semi-intelligent weapons, is that it would completely change the pattern of how warfare works, because actually most people ain't like that, but machines are, and they're completely cold and calculating and all that stuff. So the Reith lectures in which that was talked about on the BBC this year are well worth a listen, about some of the ethical challenges there are about, I can't remember the name of the guy who presents them this year, but he essentially is basically saying that general purpose artificial intelligence would be a very bad idea, and we should probably not.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not happening, right? Well, certainly not in the next 100 years, but I think what somebody said, you know, if somebody asks you to program and develop one of these things, just don't do it. You know, you just don't, right? Now, somebody is going to, right? But we should not do it. I think the other thing, I mean, the other sci-fi future that we talked about on a show this year was with Alex Wolfson. If you remember at the end of the show with him, he was talking about the fact that there are so many unidentified incursions into Chinese airspace that they can't identify, you know, where these things have come from, that they can't even count them anymore, and they've got artificial intelligence to track them and just log them down because they're, you know, it's beyond their capability to manage it. So that's also, you know, slightly, give you with this slightly. And as for George Jetson, well, I had to think about this, and I think, well, clearly it's actually quite obvious what's going on with George Jetson. George Jetson was born in 2022, and he's got this job and his family and a dog called Astro and a flying car and all that sort of thing. But it's all metaverse, right? He's just seeing it through the lens of a headset. Have you seen his dog and his daughter and his wife? It's all clearly animated, right? It's not, and the fact that, you know, he's not fooled by any of this, but he's just living his best life. He's in the metaverse, and I guess the series was cancelled, you know, before the sort of final quite sad reveal of the genuine George Jetson sitting in his underpants in his front room.
With VR headset. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, actually, maybe that's the other thing that we have progressed towards most towards in 2021 is that with the high reliance on video conferencing and the like for being able to work, and increasingly the use of things like backdrops and blurred backgrounds and all the rest, we're well on track for, if not already in the meta. Who knows if any of us are real?
Oh, well, you know, we get very Rene Descartes on us. I mean, I don't need that before I go to bed. But maybe one thing we should look for in 2022 is for us to do our first metaverse event where we're all wearing headsets and everybody can interact with each other and fiddle with each other's settings.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I do have some software that enables you to be able to work as an avatar, so maybe try that. I'm struggling enough with the real verse, let alone the metaverse.
Well, that was a helter-skelter run through another set of interesting questions from our loyal listeners, Matt, and I enjoyed that. Did you leave that enlightened or feeling better about the year gone by? What do you think?
I don't know anymore. They all merge into one once you hit your 50s, quite frankly. They're just like, it's just this endless parade of, oh my God, am I taking the Christmas decorations out again? And I talked about that last week as well. I think that it's going to be an interesting year ahead. I think it's going to be a hard year ahead. I think people are exhausted. I don't think we are taking real account of the fact that nearly 2 years now of living through a global pandemic is taking its toll emotionally on people. And I think that's going to be more and more of an issue now. But I think we hopefully will start to... I don't think we're going to come bounding out and all of a sudden the pandemic will be over by any stretch of the imagination. But I think we are learning to be able to work through it. And I think people will start to think a bit more about the future rather than the immediate now, which has been the focus for so much of the last 24 months or so.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. You know, when all this whole thing kicked off in kind of March 2020, when I stopped travelling, and I kind of thought, well, we'll be travelling again in the autumn, right? And then when that became clear it wasn't going to happen, I thought, well, as we got to the end of last year, I thought, well, by the autumn of 2021, I reckon we'll probably be through the worst of it, you know. And that was wrong. And here we are. And I think part of the mindset of going into next year, which I think, you know, you're right. I mean, people are tired of all this, and they're tired, you know, it is a struggle for many people. Is a kind of not resignation, but a kind of acceptance that this is how it is now, and it's probably going to be like this for quite a long time now, and we shouldn't be, you know, looking around the corner to a time when it's just all over and it goes away. So yeah, I think maybe that's good. Maybe that's, you know, that's everybody moving on a bit and stop clinging to the idea that one day it's going to be just like it was.
Yeah, I think that harking to being back where it was. I think the other thing though is after 2 years of this, I don't think I'm hearing that less now that it will go back to as it was. I think people have now accepted that you know, this has been a period of time like, you know, like 2008, actually, in many ways. 2008 to about 2011, and the whole, you know, collapsing of the banks and the recession and all sorts of stuff certainly changed the UK. And I don't think it is, you know, nobody thinks that we will go back to the late era of the last Labour government and it will be, you know, the mid-2000s again. That's not going to happen. I think we'll probably look back on this one as well and realise that it was a time of a sea change. And those happen, that, you know, they've happened throughout human history. We do them. We're pretty good at doing them as a species. So, but I think that it is just the exhaustion that is starting to show on quite a lot of people at the moment that I think is going to be the challenge. So with that in mind, are you taking a good rest? Are you getting some time off over the Christmas period?
I am somewhat, you know, only a week and a bit maybe, but enough certainly for me to be heading towards it with some enthusiasm for just a bit of a break and to, you know, not think about anything for a few days. And I think everybody needs it. I think we've got, you know, quite an interesting year, you know, as you say, coming up for many reasons. So I shall take my rest and we'll have a Christmas at home. And I mean, let's face it, I've already started eating sort of Christmas style.
How is the Stalin doing?
The Stalin is taking a bit of a battering, and I haven't actually gone on the scales for quite a while, because I'm a bit concerned that when I do, I should be just disappointed in myself as much as anything. But that's that's fine. We've got next year for, you know, recuperations and getting back into some sort of health.
Absolutely. I'm going to have a full 2 and a bit weeks off, which is very exciting, and I do feel quite in need of it. So we've got touring around the the United Kingdom, in fact, now, because of my sister-in-law moving to Shropshire. So we're going to be doing out to Suffolk for a bit. We're going to be doing down to, or across to Shropshire for a bit. We're going to be having Christmas Day and New Year's Day at home. And just a chance to be able to not really think about very much for a while. Most welcomed. That also means there is going to be no WB40 now until the 10th of January in the year 2022, the George Jetson was born. That's so far in the future, it's almost unimaginable. But in fact, it's only about 3 weeks. So
crazy. Well, I'm looking forward to it already, Matt.
Yeah, me too. So thank you, Chris, as ever. It's a delight.
Thank you.
And dear listener, thank you for being with us. Thank you for being a part of this crazy experiment that is WB40. It's been a long year. It's been a hard year in many ways. I hope that we have brought you things that have sparked ideas and made you curious and maybe entertained you every so often as well. We'll be back in the new year with new people. We're going to be talking about all sorts of subjects, many of which I don't know what they are yet, because that's how we roll. So we wish you a very Merry Christmas. Look forward to joining you again in 2022.
Thank you once again, and for the last time in 2021, for joining us on the WB40 podcast. You can catch us on the web at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, on all good podcasting platforms. And of course, please do leave us a review, even if you have already done so. Do it again, right? Because we just need the affirmation. Happy New Year.